It is summer. It is sweaty. And sometimes that means people show up for work trailing some pungent BO. That got NPR's Yuki Noguchi wondering, how can one tactfully tell a coworker that he or she stinks?
Kath Ludeman Hall was just out of college and a newbie at a staffing firm when she got a very tough assignment, confronting an older retail warehouse worker because his colleagues complained he stank.
The company loved him and wanted to hire him permanently. However, he did have a pretty strong body odor issue.
Ludeman Hall says he was a recent immigrant, hardworking and earnest. 20 years later, she still remembers the details. She brought a kit of deodorant and soap to offer him. In addition to overcoming her own mortification, she says she also had to bridge a difference in how his culture regarded sweat.
As a man, you know, his virility and his masculinity was associated with his smell. You know, are you asking him to redefine who he is to fit into an office, you know, an environment where he's making $4.50 an hour?
The man apologized, complied, and was eventually hired. Steve Fitzgerald is vice president of HR for Avaya, a telecom software firm. He says a global workforce does complicate matters.
There are personal hygiene standards in all societies, and there are times when people deviate from those standards. And when the deviations occur, then I think you enter into that moment as a HR professional where you groan and you think, oh gosh, I've got to go have that conversation.
That conversation, Fitzgerald says, can be triggered in any number of ways. Some people develop odors from eating spicy foods. Some don't wash their hair often.
We have a lot of older workers in the workforce nowadays, and incontinence can sometimes be an issue. Bad breath.
This is sort of like a rite of passage almost.
Margaret Feaster is director of the Knowledge Center at the Society for Human Resource Management, which fields a couple of calls every week from HR professionals asking how to broach the body odor issue. She advises discussing it in private, being direct, and showing compassion for the offender. But really, Feaster says, the people calling in often need their own moral support. I ask her where this ranks in the pantheon of embarrassing talks.
I would say this is probably number one or number two.
Feaster speaks from experience. Years ago, she had the talk with a welder working in a hot manufacturing plant in Alabama.
He was really embarrassed. I thought he was going to cry. I thought I was going to cry.
But then imagine what it's like to be on the receiving end. Jennifer LaChance struggled with severe body odor brought on by anxiety since she was a teen.
I can take several showers a day and still have some degree of odor.
Deodorants, soaps, and medication didn't solve it. LaChance says she abandoned dreams of becoming a teacher because she couldn't bear the thought of sidling up to parents at teacher conferences. Instead, she worked at an insurance firm. She says she tried being open with coworkers and supervisors about her medical issue. Still, increasingly severe emails from HR started to circulate in the office, imploring colleagues to address their BO.
After that email circulates, you've got 100 eyeballs like zeroed in on you, because nothing feels more hostile and just emotionally devastating than that.
LaChance felt deeply embarrassed, immediately left work, and resigned days later.
I just felt like, wow, there's just no place for me. I never wanted to walk in an office again. I don't want to be an offensive person to anybody.
Now she says she's back in school studying medical data management, a job she says she can do largely from home and avoid having body odor be an issue for her at work. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News, Washington.
Banking regulators in New York State are expected to release new rules this week governing bitcoins and other virtual currencies. From member station WSHU, Charles Lane reports that many industry experts welcome the regulations, but some worry that they could end up limiting the creative potential of this new way of doing business.
In many ways, virtual currencies are just like old-fashioned money. You can buy furniture, books, beer, whatever. But some say it's even better than money.
Just anecdotally, I was getting my hair cut this weekend at my...
That's John Johnson. He's chairman of the internet retailer Overstock.com. At a public hearing in New York, he told regulators even hairstylists will want Bitcoin.
She asked me, tell me about Bitcoin.
Johnson knows a lot about virtual currencies because his company was one of the first to accept bitcoins, the digital money invented a few years ago. He says Bitcoin is better than money because anyone online can cut out middlemen, making transactions cheaper.
She said, I would love to have something that didn't have interchange fee, where I wasn't giving 3% of every haircut to the credit card companies.
Virtual currencies stand to revolutionize financial services, but they are still largely unregulated, a fact that ignites the imagination and consternation of many in the financial sector. Now New York State is about to step into this regulatory void. Within days, it will issue far-reaching rules focusing on three things: consumer protection, cybersecurity, and anti-money laundering rules. Gil Loria studies financial technology companies at Wedbush Securities.
It's very difficult for a Bitcoin business to function right now because they don't have a natural regulator.
Loria says there are some federal laws that Bitcoin companies have to obey so as to not launder money or fund terrorism, but the rules aren't clear enough.
There's processes to make sure that you know what the customer is doing, and then there's processes of reporting things that look suspicious. So the regulation of all that, for Bitcoin businesses, you don't necessarily have that.
But some in the industry worry that New York could go too far and create anti-money laundering rules that define and limit Bitcoin before we really know what it can do.
So that's just it. We have no idea. The power of the Bitcoin protocol is enormous.
Marco Santori is a lawyer specializing in financial transactions. He says that while on the surface Bitcoin is a currency, underneath it's something more. It's a secure system for electronically transferring things of value from person to person. That could be money, or it might be the deed to a house, or a copyright, or really anything you wouldn't want counterfeited. Santori says it's short-sighted to regulate Bitcoin as if it were money, when in 20 years, it could be so much more.
Had the federal government come down, say, and started regulating the predecessor to the internet and said, look, this is a very powerful tool for terrorist communications, we should require licensing for anybody using this tool, it's unlikely that we would now have Amazon.com.
Most in the industry agree that rules dealing with consumer protection and cybersecurity would be welcome. As of right now, there is no single authority that could help consumers recover lost funds if a Bitcoin company goes under. Nor are there rules that require third-party security audits that could prevent the theft of what is essentially bits and bytes on a computer somewhere. For NPR News, I'm Charles Lane in New York.
Now the business of lotteries, America's modern era of state-run lotteries, started half a century ago in New Hampshire. Today, across 43 states, the District of Columbia, and several territories, people wager more than $56 billion a year on lotteries. The take for state governments is about a third of that. In many states, lottery revenues exceed revenue from corporate income taxes. As Steve Tripley reports, the big winners in that equation include politicians, who get money for government services without having to raise taxes. And the other big winner? The non-gambling public.
The machine spitting out lottery betting slips is busy this midday Monday at Santo Domingo Liquors in Lawrence, Massachusetts. The store has two cash registers. Only the lottery register has a line when I arrive. Elizabeth Correa, 8 months pregnant, is running that register with her mother. Her family owns the store.
We do this 7 days a week. 7 days a week. My mom sometimes she'll do it open to closing.
Santo Domingo Liquors took in $1,237,000 in lottery bets last year. It's Lawrence's fifth largest lottery vendor. With 77,000 people, this mostly poor city has 78 lottery outlets, one for every 1,000 residents, in convenience stores, liquor stores, gas stations, bars, and restaurants.
Ay, 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 otra vez contigo.
Ay, 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 you again, Elizabeth Correa jokes as she rings up a lottery regular. He's an elderly man who speaks Spanish and won't give his name to a guy with a microphone. I ask how often he plays.
¿Cuántas veces por semana juega usted?
Los siete días a la semana. Los siete días a la semana.
Siete días. 7 days a week.
Mm-hmm.
He allows that he's just won $200. Correa says that may explain why he didn't want to give his name. But now he's turned $44 of his winnings into new bets. Correa says that's not uncommon for winners. She points to a table where gamblers fill in their numbers or scratch their scratch tickets.
They buy it, they go over there, they scratch it, they come back over here, cash it in. And then we sell them some more, and they go back, scratch it, come over here, cash them, buy more.
Constant rebetting cuts the payback from lotteries significantly, and the official payback rate's not that good. Massachusetts returns on average about 73% of every bet, the highest of any lottery, but still dramatically worse than the 90-plus percent payback of most casino games. Why would anyone play such bad odds? With thousands of outlets in each state, Massachusetts has 7,400, economists say the sheer availability of lotteries gives them a decisive market edge. Cornell University economics and management professor David Just offers another reason why gamblers bite.
What appears to be happening is that they really believe that there's going to be a return on this investment.
Just and his colleagues crunched lottery data from 39 states. He says many people, especially the less educated, simply don't understand how abysmal their chances are. Even if everyone did understand, Just says his research shows why some still might play.
It's the desperation play. People don't treat it like entertainment. Instead, those, particularly those who are poor, are treating this more as an investment opportunity. It's their Hail Mary pass to try and make it big.
Lottery officials around the country insist that for most players, lotteries really are just entertainment. And with playing voluntary, no one's targeted. That may be true, but Just says one other thing jumped out from his research.
To me, the astounding thing was looking at how much the prevalence of people out down around the poverty rate, particularly people who are on different forms of welfare, that those really did correlate so tightly with lottery play.
Studies from the Carolinas to California, Illinois, and Connecticut echo that. At least some lotteries acknowledge their market indirectly. An Ohio marketing plan once suggested that lottery ads be timed to coincide with the receipt of government benefits. Lottery advertising, and in many states there's a lot of it, favors friendlier themes. This TV spot from Oregon soothingly touts the services lottery profits by.
Introducing Cottonwood Canyon. Funded in part with $13 million lottery dollars, providing recreational adventure for generations of Oregonians to come. The Oregon Lottery. It does good things.
Lottery revenues do fund good things, recreation, education, and public safety. And the majority who hardly ever gamble get those services without paying full cost. For the gamblers, opportunities are multiplying. Under competitive pressure, the people who run state lotteries keep launching new games, new advertising, new price points, and juiced-up payouts. Back at Santo Domingo Liquors, a display case holds an array of 44 scratch tickets. There's one for every budget, $1, $2, $5, $10, $20. Owner Elizabeth Correa pulls out another one.
We got the $30 ticket.
Say that again?
$30 ticket.
Is that new?
Yes.
How new is that?
About what, 2-3 weeks, month?
Less than a month.
The $30 world-class million scratch ticket is the state's newest. Massachusetts is simply keeping up with the six other states that have rolled out $30 tickets in recent months. Every state lottery website has a link to counseling for problem gamblers. But the flow of cash from these games raises questions about whether state governments are becoming a different sort of gambling addict. For NPR News, I'm Steve Tripoli.
Let's talk a little more now about the effort to refill the Federal Highway Trust Fund, which is expected to run out of cash later this summer. A short-term fix passed the House earlier this week, and the Senate is set to consider a similar measure. That's the short term. Then there's the question of the longer term. One possible solution from the White House would let states collect tolls on interstate highways. They've been prohibited from doing that for decades. Here's NPR's Brian Naylor.
It's a weekday morning, and cars and trucks stream past toll booth number 10 on the Chesapeake Bay Bridge. It's on the western end of the 4.3-mile-long span that crosses the Chesapeake near Annapolis, Maryland.
Hi.
Nancy Althoff is the toll shift supervisor.
Thank you.
Althoff has been collecting tolls here since 1969. Most of the time, she says she enjoys her work, but there are mornings when it's stressful, when traffic is backed up, or drivers are unhappy with the toll.
Last year, when the toll went up in July, people were kind of upset because it had just gone up, and it then went November of the year before, and they were kind of upset. And I think, actually, some people thought it was going to go up July of this year.
Drivers around the country might find themselves upset if the administration's proposal to allow states to toll interstate highways goes through. The administration says the new tolls could raise some $87 billion to pay for the upkeep of interstates, but the proposal is facing some barriers of its own. The Alliance for Toll-Free Interstates includes corporations such as McDonald's, UPS, and FedEx. It says the plan would amount to double taxation and hit low wage workers especially hard. Julian Walker is the group's spokesman.
The minimum wage is $7.25. If you put a $4 toll on that road, that could cause a worker going to and from work to work essentially an extra hour just to pay for the commuting cost.
He says putting tolls on interstates would divert traffic onto other roads less equipped to handle high traffic volumes and amount to double taxation because the roads have already been paid for. But the International Bridge, Tunnel, and Turnpike Association, which represents companies that collect tolls, has a different view. Patrick Jones, the group's CEO, says it's like paying off a mortgage.
And even though you own the house free and clear, that doesn't remove you of the responsibility to maintain and proper upkeep of the house. The same is true of a highway and the interstate highway system. The states own the right of way. They put the initial pavement down there, but in many cases the pavement has worn away. There's potholes, there's rutting, etc., and it needs to be replaced.
Jones says most states would probably use electronic toll collection systems. But so far, the idea of allowing states to impose tolls on interstate highways has gotten little traction in Congress. Transportation analyst Robert Puentes of the Brookings Institution says it's best viewed as part of a larger solution.
Tolling on the interstates is not going to be the silver bullet solution for fixing our transportation challenges overall. It's certainly going to help, and again, if it's used for maintenance of an existing roadway, that's certainly going to help certain states and cities and metropolitan areas. But if we're looking for systemic changes and systemic fixes to the larger system, it's going to take something like a gasoline tax.
But raising the gas tax is almost certainly not going to happen this year either, which is why lawmakers are looking at a patchwork of smaller fixes to put the problem off until after Election Day and leave it to the next Congress to solve. Brian Naylor, NPR News, Washington.